Welcome, everyone, to our second session with Professor Elaine Frenz from Kent State University. Her topic today is America Retreats from the Promises of Reconstruction. And last week, I think, ended with wonderful discussion. We'll have this again. And I think we learned a lot, and we're all ready to learn some more.
I am really surprised so many people are here. This is great. Yeah, I thought the freezing weather would. Is this working? Did I do it right? It's on.
I think you did it right.
Yeah, I tried this. Yeah.
But I forgot to say one thing. Next week, we are at 8:45 due to the 10 o'clock service. So I hope it won't be as cold. There'll be coffee by 8:30. So hope to see you then. Sorry.
The fact is, it will be as cold. We know that, right?
Will you have worms for the early birds who show up?
We should bring donuts. I guess you have donuts over there somewhere, probably. But okay, well, welcome, everybody. I'm glad you're here. Is tech good? Okay, that's a thumbs up. Okay, excellent. Good. So today we're going to be talking about the reconstruction, and I apologize for the typo on my title page. So I realized it this morning, but I'd already sent it. So it is not American Retreats from the Promises of Reconstruction, but America Retreats from the Promises of Reconstruction. So today I want to talk about what Reconstruction was. And this is all, again, to give you the context. This is all to build up to next week's discussion, which will be where things get really violent on the streets of Pittsburgh. Right. And so this is all context for that. We started, by talking about the challenge of labor and how churches in particular were thinking through the challenge of labor and class tension that was emerging during this time. And now today we're going to be talking about one of the most important things that happens in 1877. If you remember your U.S. history textbooks, they often end in 1877. Like when your U.S. history is split in half, it's often split in half at 1877, right? And the reason is because of this, because this is when Reconstruction ends. So this is often seen as, you know, kind of an important boundary in U.S. history. And so we'll start talking about what Reconstruction was, and then when we talk next week about the Great Strike in Pittsburgh that killed 22 Pittsburghers, then we'll have this context of what's going on in the South to understand it, because that's very significant. Okay, so what was Reconstruction? And this also tie back to last week a little bit. Okay, we're going to talk about what was Reconstruction and then emerging problems with Reconstruction. And then finally, we'll talk about the election of 1876 and the end of Reconstruction. Okay, I'm sorry these images are so small. I tried to make them as big as possible, which is why my words are a little bit smushed. But what was Reconstruction? So Reconstruction was the dream of, now that we've sacrificed so incredibly much, you know, sacrificed so much, you know, in terms of what, blood and treasure, you know, we've sacrificed all, you know, so many men. We've sacrificed, you know, so many years of our lives. We've sacrificed so much money to, you know, and now our president, you know, Lincoln has been killed. You know, what are we going to do to make this have been worth it? We want to do something perfect. So people are really invested and positive and enthusiastic, but also deeply, deeply committed, in making the value of the sacrifice worth it, right? People up in the North. And what Reconstruction is the plan of how we're going to do that. How are we going to make this have been worth it? And we're going to make this war have been a moral triumph and victory that ushers in a beautiful new age of equality, right? And even though a lot of even Northerners at the beginning of the war were not necessarily, they tended to be anti-slavery, but a lot of even Northern soldiers at the beginning were not necessarily all about ending slavery, right? By the end of the war had become the battle to end slavery. for Northerners. People who had been skeptical about that had come around, right? And this now had become the purpose of the war. So this is an image made right at the end of the war to talk about what the vision of Reconstruction would be. And this has a whole bunch of political leaders, national political leaders, and then you have images of the South, you know, down at the bottom. And what they're doing is they're going to build this kind of new temple, right? Or a sort of new democracy, a new forum, right? You know, almost in a classical style that will lead to equality for all citizens and make worthwhile all the work of the people who have gone before us. And this is another image I really like from 1869 by Thomas Nast, Uncle Sam's Thanksgiving Dinner. And it has, if you can look in there, it has, you know, white people, black people, it has Chinese people, a Chinese family, it has a Muslim family, it has, you know, what appears to be maybe a Syrian woman, you can see the back of her head, you know, but it's, and it has indigenous people, and they're all gathered around the table for the American Thanksgiving. And so it's a time of great idealism, where people, you know, truly have confidence that where we can move in this positive direction. And the positive direction we want to move in is the direction of equality and community and freedom. Structurally, the other, you know, part of Reconstruction is protecting freed people, in this case, we're protecting freed people from the abuses of white Southerners, right? And so Northerners imagine themselves as sort of, you know, allied with freed people and bringing in their superior might to protect the weak from this kind of angry mob of white Southerners who have attempted to enslave them and now might attempt to you know, oppress them in other ways. So structurally, what's going on now is that you have the national government is run by the Republican Party, the Party of Lincoln, right? It's the Republican Party. And the Republican Party is most Northern whites, right, are in the Republican Party. And then Black Southerners are going to come in and join the Republican Party. Remember, the thing about the Republican Party is that it basically is very new, right? You know, the Republican Party was just created in the 1850s, and they kind of don't know what their party looks like when there's not a war, or not a war coming, right? It's a party that was created around the issue of largely issue of sectional tensions with the South. So the question is, will this party, how, what does this party even look like after the war is over? And so the coalition they're trying to build in the North is going to be a coalition between most Northern whites, and that's going to be particularly our churchgoers, our Protestant churchgoers, right, who are really powerful political force. They're going to be at the center of the Republican coalition, right? And they're going to ally with, they're going to bring in a whole bunch of new voters in the South, right, who are Black Southern voters. And that's going to be the model, the political model. Now, who's not in the Republican Party? Southern whites, right? Most of Southern whites, though there's always like some Southern white who never got around, you know, along with his neighbors or whatever, you know, or who's going to ally with Southern Blacks. So there's going to be some Southern whites who are going to ally with the Northerners and Southern Black people. But also immigrants in general, immigrants coming in are more inclined to join the Democratic Party, particularly Irish immigrants of whom there are many. Okay. So there's a partisan split. The Republicans are trying to rebuild themselves after the war. Protestants are on the side of the Republicans, and so are freed people. So what the Reconstruction is the plan, the specific plan through which the party in power the Republicans are going to implement a new system in the South, which will allow for Black empowerment. Okay, partially for partisan reasons, but also for these moral reasons. Okay, they're going to do a couple other things too. So one thing that they're going to do is it's going to be really important that they keep their armies down there. We won't talk about all the details of it. They withdraw some of the armies and they send some of them back, right? But it's basically going to be the case that what Reconstruction is a military occupation of the South. They're going to keep the North is going to keep a lot of soldiers down there, okay? But not enough soldiers. They're going to keep soldiers. If you look at those dots, and that's why I like this map, those soldiers really can't move very far. They can't safely leave their headquarters and go any more than the distance they can move during the day and back and be back at home at night because it's too hostile in the South. So there's a lot of territories in the South which really aren't served by the military, right? Aren't occupied. Okay, but you have a military occupation and that's going to be part of it. You're going to have the federal government is going to set up a system through which Black Southerners will be enfranchised. That's going to be by requiring Southern states to enfranchise them as a condition of their returning to the Union, basically, or getting their political power back on the federal level. So part of Reconstruction was enfranchising freed people. In the South, and then they figure, well, while we're at it, let's go ahead and pass an amendment and also enfranchise Black people in the North, right, who haven't been allowed to vote. So basically, it's enfranchising Black voters in the North and South. These two things can go together. I wish you could see this picture better, but basically, this is a Texas polling place, and it's surrounded by soldiers. Soldiers are posted all around the sides, and it's because freed people are voting at this poll in Texas, and so the soldiers are protecting the poll from violence to allow these freed people to vote. However, let's just note this: how do people feel when they go to vote, and there are soldiers posted around the place where they're going to vote? Well, that's I think it's relevant, right? It's perceived as intimidating, right? By white Southerners. And what white Southerners say is, well, you say you have these voters here to keep the elections fair, but actually you have the voters there to intimidate us from voting, right? To control the elections. Okay, so that's happening. So the soldiers are there protecting freed people's rights to vote, and that's part of Reconstruction. Yes.
Former slave owners who lost their land.
Well, they ended up, how did they enfranchise the owners? How did they get the vote back? You mean? Oh, yeah. How did the white people get the vote back? Well, it's actually it's a system that's different in each place. But basically, what happened was when freed people are enfranchised, they set up the people who are allowed to vote, and at first that aren't the former Confederates, the people who are allowed to vote, so white people who were not disenfranchised, right, and freed people set up conventions, they pass new constitutions, and in these constitutions, all of them agree to allow the restoration of the vote to white people who had been in the Confederacy. So that's part of it. And then there's something at the federal level with Johnson. Right, who John, but that's it gets complicated because there's different iterations of this. But at the federal level, President Johnson also pardons a lot of former Confederates, most former Confederates. So, in various ways, within a couple of years, former Confederates, even leaders, are back voting. And partially it's because freed people actually vote in these constitutions to allow white Confederates to come back and vote for reasons that are again kind of complicated, but it's also because they have to rebuild their communities. They have to reintegrate, right? And they're working to do that. So, okay, the other things that happen with Reconstruction is attempting to do things like They send down, they establish something called the Freedmen's Bureau, and the Freedmen's Bureau is basically military officers who take on civilian roles, and they just go in and live in these small towns in the South, and they try to intervene personally in conflicts between freed people and white Southerners. So they might themselves, these former military officers, might oversee contracts. That's an important thing, the labor contracts, because maybe the freed people can't read, right? So they have to, so the they're kind of overseeing what they call the fairness of these contracts, and things like that. They're also distributing food. This is our first federal welfare program. It's the first time that the federal government gives practical support to residents of the United States. Okay, and it's done in a pretty large scale, and it's basically done by the military, which is kind of rebranded as, you know, part of it is kind of rebranded as the Freedmen's Bureau. And I could go on about this forever because it's fascinating, but I need to move on to other things. But I will say, when you picture the one thing that's happening here is the federal government is just becoming bureaucratically competent, partially because of the experience of the war. People have learned how to do bureaucracy, right? And so part of what happens is these guys, these men, they will just get off a train. They'll be like, okay, you're in Unionville. They'll get off a train. They'll have nothing. And they'll just have to say, Ken, is there a building here that I can be in? They'll have to find a building. They'll have to, is somebody going to pay for me to have paper? You know, like it's at that level. I followed some of these guys' papers, and they're just like, they just land there and they find themselves a building. They rent it. They try to get reimbursed for it. They try to get some paper and stationery supplies, and they figure out what needs to be done. And then occasionally they get like a, you know, a letter from headquarters that says, well, you've really got to take care of this problem we're hearing about. And then they'll try to figure out how to do that. Right. Sometimes they have access to troops nearby, right, that they can do that. But basically, you have this Freedmen's Bureau, which is like the beginning of the welfare state in the United States, right? Really important. What they don't do, however, and one thing about the Freedmen's Bureau is if you're then a person working for the American Missionary Society, right, or, you know, if you're some other, you know, well-meaning, you know, Northerner who wants to come down and help teach, right, or something like that, that's going to be your contact person. The fact that there's a Freedmen's Bureau agent there will make you feel safer going to that community to go and teach or whatever. So he becomes kind of like the contact person for that. Okay, the other thing that they do, so here's a Freedmen's School, which are largely supported by the Freedmen's Bureau and kind of logistically supported by them. Often the buildings are built by freed people themselves, and the Freedmen's Bureau might help to fund something, or you know, might help them get property for it or something like that. Okay. And then the other freed people, the purpose of the Freedmen's Bureau also is to empower Black Southerners to take an even role within Southern society in other ways, right? So this is a Black school teacher. She's a former enslaved person, and she becomes a teacher in one of these freedmen's school. And so another goal of the Freedmen's Association or the Freedmen's Bureau is to empower Black people to ultimately be able to do things themselves, right? And I mentioned before the American Missionary Association, including a lot of Presbyterian money, you know, is spent in building schools to train freed people to be their own teachers, right, to normal schools. Okay, the other thing that they're interested in doing is making sure that there's equality under the law for Black Southerners. So any laws that discriminate between white and Black, like, oh, if you kill somebody and you're Black, you get this punishment, but if you kill somebody and you're white, you get this punishment. You know, any sort of specific legal differentiations between these two groups, or like if you're a vagrant and you're Black, this happens. If you're a vagrant and you're white, this happens. You know, they're also working on enforcing equality under the legal system. Okay. What they're not doing, however, and this is really important, is property redistribution. Okay. What they're not doing is giving any money, like they're not giving wages to, and they're not giving land to freed people. So freed people had kind of fought, and some white people, there was actually a push in the North, to like give freed people to break up the plantation lands of disloyal people who'd fought in the Confederacy and give it to freed people who had been working there. This did not happen. It had very little support in the North. Okay, and that's really, really important. So freed people now have the rights, they have some skills that they're developing, they have like a guy in a building who's trying to who has their back, right? They have some soldiers, maybe not too far away, but what they don't have any way to make money, right? They don't have any property or any way to make money.
Giving them land.
That's exactly what we're going to talk about today. Right? Because there's a way that Northerners feel about the redistribution of wealth to the workers. Right? And that's, I mean, that's part of the problem, right? Is it comes to be framed that way. Okay. So challenges to Reconstruction that start to emerge. Southern white pushback. First of all, the Ku Klux Klan that we're all familiar with. It emerges in 1868. So 3 years after the war, you start getting the emergence of the Ku Klux Klan, and it remains important to 1871. So about 3 years, you have 4 years, you have terrible Klan violence, and there's also violence from groups that are like Klans but aren't called Klans. But basically, you have some collective violence, and the purpose of this violence is to keep freed people from voting. But it's also to keep freed people from like owning their own land. If it's kind of complicated, but first of all, there were some Black people who were free before the war in the South. It was a small minority, but some of them had some money. And so actually part of what's happening is some Black people right away actually do okay in setting up their own farms and even buy buggies and things like that. And or buy like small businesses or like buy a grocery store, start a business, that kind of thing happens for some elite, relatively elite Black people in the South. Some of them were literate, right? Some of them have connections to wealthy Northerners, personal connections, right? And so what happens is the Klan is attacking people who want to vote, but the Klan is also attacking people who have a lot of money and are not in their place, are kind of like, why do you have a buggy? And I don't have a buggy. Klans are like actually going, among other things, they're going and stealing from people, which is kind of crazy. But if there are Black families that do have money, which there are, even very early on, the Klan is like, I'll take that shirt, or whatever. They're just like, because there's a lot of really poor whites. And part of what the Klan does is just go and steal from people. So it's like theft. The Klan is also just, demanding deference, saying, well, why aren't you being more respectful to white people around you? Like the Klan's also like engaged in a lot of oppression of women. So they particularly they're like they want to show Black men, especially maybe like returning Black soldiers might have a lot of dignity. And they want to show them, oh, you can't really control your household. So they'll come and like rape women, or they'll rape women and say, also make me dinner, So it was a lot of that kind of thing. Yeah.
Some of it still goes on today. Driving while being Black.
Yeah, that's right. And early, I hadn't thought about that. Early driving while Black. But it's like
But that goes on.
showing wealth and prosperity was something that would attract the attention of the Klan. Okay. The Klan also, yeah, that's a really good point. The Klan also attacks white people who ally with Black people. So I don't know. I'm just making this number up, but I'm very familiar with the sources. Something like 10% of attacks, or a little bit more than that, are on white people who took the side of Black people. So that would either be Southern whites who've always been there, but ally with Black people, or largely it's going to be Northerners coming down to be teachers or to make some money, right? Because you can buy land cheap. And so those folks are very likely to be attacked by the Klan as well. So the Klan is basically, attacking people, and that's causing problems. That's one of the ways that we're pushed back against in the Reconstruction Project. But I also want to say that the vast majority of violence by white people against Black people during this period was not the Klan. The Klan, we just talk about the Klan because it's most, I have a book about the Klan, right? But like we just focus on the Klan because it's the easiest thing to visualize. It's a sensational, thing. But most violence was just like a white person has a Black person working for them and they get mad at them and so they beat them, and they beat them so bad that they die of their wounds, or something like that. And then nothing happens, right? So the vast majority of white on Black violence was that, but the Klan violence gets a lot of press because it's people are wearing costumes and whatnot. Okay. So Southern whites work to push out Northern assistance. Okay. Another problem with the Klan is Northern white racial attitudes, right? Northern, it's not that Northern white people, are somehow don't have racial assumptions about Black people, right? And so they often think, well, Black people are, we're helping them, but maybe they're not very competent themselves, right? So there's a kind of a way in which, even at this time, Northerners, even though they're helping Black Southerners, they're also skeptical about the ability of Black Southerners to really govern themselves. And then also, they expect a lot of appreciation from Black Southerners. So they'll get unhappy if Black Southerners are like critical of them. So they'll say, well, we're going to come down and like, we're going to build a school. And then, like some Black Southerners might be like, "But wait a minute, we don't want to learn this. We want to learn that." And they'll be like, "Why don't you understand that? Like, we have your best interest at heart, So there was a little bit of tension even in those, because of kind of Northern racial ideas. There's also a desire in the North, what they call the romance of reunion. This desire to get back together and to come to terms with, to make friends again with the Southern whites that used to be our friends. Many of them are our family members connected to us. We want our churches to get back together that have split over this issue, right? We want our organizations to get back together. We want to rebuild. So there's a desire to kind of like reunify with and kind of come to an understanding, place the past in the past and rebuild the nation. Yes.
One of the things I'll talk about, and just looking back on that time period, is that let's just say you had two corporations, excuse me, that were highly competitive. One buys the other, and you're melding those two cultures.
Yes.
They do training, they would talk about it more openly. It never happened with Reconstruction because it was such a national issue. It was so cultural and embedded.
Yes.
It's just amazing how even
Can you
it
read it
as
again?
well as it did.
Yeah, can you repeat that? Yeah, no, that's
Please repeat.
yeah. Could you repeat it? Because they couldn't hear you on the Zoom.
Well, what I was saying was that if we look back on that time, people are looking back on it and saying, well, if there were two corporate, I'm just giving an example, if there were two corporations that had been highly competitive with one another, didn't talk, sort of fought, I mean, I'm making this extreme, and one bought the other one, then you would go in and do training. You would talk about the differences in cultures. I mean, it's a microcosm of what happened on the national level, but nothing like that happened during Reconstruction. And people who had been, subservient, people who had been masters are suddenly sort of thrown together in a way that was terribly uncomfortable for people.
No, they didn't have a structured way to do it. And what they did do was like, they'd have novels about rebuilding the connections between Northern and Southern whites. It would be like, and that's why they call it a romance of reunion. But there'd be all these kind of like novels about like my brother's in the South, and here's how we, became close again, So there was kind of efforts to deal with that, but there weren't, like workshops or, what we might try to do today. That's a good point. Okay, so all of these are things that are standing in the way of Reconstruction. But the last one is kind of what we were alluding to earlier, I think, right? Which is, what do we think about the relationship between owners and workers? And part of the problem is that in the South, the things that the freedmen are asking for, they're saying, I've worked in this place my whole life. I put my blood into this. So did my family before me. And I deserve a portion. I should own it, just because I'm the one who's always been working it. I should maybe have an ownership right in it. So that sounds appealing in some ways, right? Especially if you're really mad at the white Southerners who, fought the war. But it also sounds like something else, and that something else, communism, is really all over the place now. Okay, so remember, Karl Marx is, and Marx and Engels, they're active in the 1850s, starting in the 1850s, right during the Civil War. They're writing about the Civil War in American newspapers. Like, there's columns by Engels, in like New York newspapers. Like, communism is something which is a very live and new, and seemingly, nobody knows what's going to happen with it, right? Idea at this time. And this idea that workers should have some sort of ownership right, is something that's problematic to people that own things, right? And the Republicans, I mentioned before that the Republicans are a coalition of sort of, northern whites and particularly reformers, right? And southern black voters, new southern black voters. But actually, another characteristic of them is they tend to be the pro-business people, right? The Republicans are also, at this time, they're the party of evangelical Christianity, and they're also the party of prosperity, right? They're the wealthier people, right? They're say the outer suburbs, right? They're kind of like, they want to do good things, they're wealthy, but they're not really down with communism, right? Or the idea of redistribution of wealth. Okay, so, and I just mentioned this here. So this is just a 1876, right before, this is a year before we're gonna have these uprisings. This is a Pittsburgh newspaper. And it's just, I just looked through for, strikes in Pittsburgh in, 1876, and just pulled something. But so at this very time that we have Reconstruction, we're pouring all this money into it, Black people are wanting more, right? And at the same time, laborers are rising up, and there's increasing numbers of strikes in Pittsburgh and everywhere else, the big cities. And they call it the labor question. And the labor question is, what do we owe to our workers? How much rights should workers have to the increasing prosperity of the nation? Okay, and then the final problem, challenge of Reconstruction, is going to be the problem of there's a great big whopping recession. Okay, and this recession starts in 1873. It's called the Panic of 1873. And these are just, I don't know, these are just people responding to the Panic of 1873. But basically, it's going to put the entire United States into a deep, we had so much prosperity in the North during the war and after the war. It was really good for business, right? And really good for, it's just an incredibly prosperous time. In 1873, that's going to end. It's going to end basically because of instability in bonds, railroad bonds in particular. So basically, people had invested and building all this infrastructure after the war, and there were some problems with the investment structure. And so you start having a huge collapse of the economy, called the Panic of 1873. And it's going to be really, really bad. And it's going to hit individuals, but also governments, aren't going to have enough money to do the things that they're used to doing. And one way that we could cut money, cut expenses, would be to stop funding this really expensive reconstruction project, right? So that's another thing that's happening. A huge, huge important recession, which is going to stretch until after 1877. Yes.
What Johnson against all this anyway?
Yeah, well, Johnson's out by 1868, right? But Johnson wanted to have there be an easier path, so that we wouldn't do this reconstruction. This is really called, everything we're talking about is really congressional reconstruction or radical reconstruction, because the more interventionist Republicans won the power struggle in Washington. Johnson's really a Democrat. Lincoln chose a Democrat to run with him to balance the ticket during war for unity. But the Republicans really take the reins from Johnson. In the election, to move on to the last bit here, what really happens is in the election of 1876, so this is right before this huge 1877 labor uprising and also the end of Reconstruction, you have a presidential election. And the presidential election is between the Republican Rutherford B. Hayes. Rutherford B. Hayes and the Democrat Samuel Tilden. And the 1876 election is enormously, here's just to kind of see how Tilden is pitching himself, right? This election is going to be enormously it's going to be enormously high turnout. It's going to actually have the highest voter turnout of any election in U.S. history. That seems like it might be kind of a boring election, right? But basically, what's happening with this election is it's like the war's over. It's been over for a while. We're having huge economic problems. The Republicans are in charge, right? You know, during the time they're having these huge economic problems. We haven't talked about U.S. Grant. But he's been a Republican president during this time, and he's been enormously, tragically corrupt, right? You know, very corrupt president. Everybody kind of knew it. So there were just a lot of problems with the Republicans. And so the question is, you know, what happens to our country now that this war is over? Are we going to restore a two-party system, right? Are the Democrats ever going to be able to win the presidency again? You know, are the Republicans that actually going to be able to succeed in rebuilding this coalition? Is this going to work? You know, what's going to happen? So it really seemed like this was a very impactful election, a huge amount of turnout. Again, we still have troops at the polls in the South. We have troops in the polls. The Klan is gone. There's no more Klan, but there is plenty of violence at the polls in that at this time when you vote. You don't have privacy, right? When you vote at this time, there's a guy standing at the poll with a stack of ballots for the Democrats, and there's another guy standing at the poll with a stack of ballots for the Republicans, and they're surrounded probably by their friends with guns, right? And they're standing there, and then you walk up to one of them, you take one of those, you know, ballots, and you might be illiterate. Right, which is one reason why you need to do it this way. But you take one of those ballots, you walk into a house or a saloon or wherever it is, and then you put the ballot in. But everybody standing there can see you do it, can see exactly how you vote, right? And you have to get through maybe a crowd of people, and there is a bunch of people, perhaps with guns, you know, sitting around or lurking around or just, you know, and there's a lot of it's this isn't new. This is how elections had always been. It was particularly dramatic, right, in the South, given the political situation. But it was very common to have fist fights on polling day. You know, polling places are often in bars, right, in saloons. That was one of the most, because there weren't that many public spaces, right? And they believed in separation of church and state, so they weren't going to put it in churches. They're basically, you know, but so it's often in bars or in somebody's house. But basically, there's a huge amount of violence around polls. That's pretty common. Freed people deal with that by marching together to polls, you know, in like large groups. But, you know, that's also going to cause problems. So, what starts to, you know, what's happening at this time with voting is the guy who has to pick up the ballots and get on a horse and take it to whatever small town poll is getting attacked and beaten up or killed, right? And his ballots are taken, and then you don't have any ballots, right? So you guys can't vote at that poll, right? Or People are ballot stuffing like crazy, right? Whoever's in control of that polling place is just taking like 20 of those ballots, just stuffing it in there, right? So you have all sorts of irregularities at the polls. As a result of this, and that's honestly, that's happening in the North and the South. And we could talk about Boss Tweed in New York City, right? This is the era of machine politics. We can talk about in Pittsburgh, we could really talk about it. But for, in Pittsburgh, it's very common to have people beaten up or in later years going to be shot. People are going to be shot on election day, because of things like this. Really heavy turnout, hugely heavy turnout. Yeah, in spite of that. No, that's exactly right. So 82%, or let's say 82% ballots representing 82% of the population were cast. Right? I guess you're right. We don't really know how many of those are actually people showing up. Good point. Okay, so what happens is it's unclear who won. This is going to be a familiar story, right? So election day comes, election day goes, four states. It is Florida, Louisiana, South Carolina, and I don't even really understand what happened in Oregon, but Oregon, okay? These states all, it's unclear who won the state election because one side says, well, you had armed guards there and you wouldn't let us come in and vote. The other side said, well, you beat up all the black voters and wouldn't let them, come in and vote. And so basically, both of them were kind of saying the results are just not to be trusted, right? So as a result, and this will also feel familiar, both sides sent electors to DC. So you have two separate, for four states, you have two separate groups of electors that come to DC for, the procedure of authorizing the vote. And so the question is, who gets to decide? Congress is controlled by the Republicans, but Democrats insist that they can't just allow the Republican, the head of the Senate, Thomas Ferry, to make the determination on his own. So they have a compromise. Congress decides that they're going to appoint a commission, and the commission, which is a bipartisan commission, is going to go through all the details. They're going to actually go down and take testimony from people who are at the polling places and things like that. They're going to decide what actually happened, and they're going to come up with a winner. The problem is, and it's going to be a secret commission, it's behind closed doors. The problem is that they take so long doing this, right? The new president is supposed to become president March 4th. And, January comes around, nobody knows who's going to be president. February comes around, nobody knows who's going to be president, right? March 2nd, they finally come up with a plan. And the plan is what they all agree to behind closed doors, and there's still debate about what really happened. But what they basically agree to is that the Republican Hayes will become the new president, but the federal government will end Reconstruction, take all the soldiers back, and everybody understands that that means black people won't be able to vote anymore, right? That's very clear and explicit, and they basically people talk about it, right? That's going to be the impact of it. Without those soldiers protecting the polling places, black people, not everywhere, black people will continue to vote in some places, but black people in places with relatively even black-white populations, which is where the Klan was strongest and where the violence was strongest, those people will not be allowed to vote anymore. And so that decision was made, and that's called the Compromise of 1877, and that's considered the end of Reconstruction. And
What was, I have a question. What was the leverage that the Democrats had in this process if the Republicans controlled the House, the Congress?
So the Democrats, what was their leverage? Why did they listen to them at all?
Right.
Well, part of it is that Tilden actually had won more votes. Like he definitely had won the popular vote. And there's actually a lot of people, like powerful people up in the north, wealthy people up in the north, who are Democrats. A lot of, New York City is like, controlled by a Democratic coalition. So just a lot of kind of people who are economically powerful, socially powerful, are Democrats at this point. And then also there was a sense that because Tilden had won the popular vote, that that meant something, right? And so there was kind of a lot of popular support, to, that the Democrats ought to be taken seriously. There was a lot of concern about Republican corruption because of Grant's behavior. U.S. Grant had been enormously corrupt, right, in his particularly economically, but there was a lot of kind of distrust of the integrity of government at this time. And so I think that Southern whites' complaints that they felt that the troops were like oppressing them or whatever, I think that those were taken seriously by some people, maybe even some Republicans were concerned about the occupation of polls by troops, right, and things like that. A lot of people kind of want, and then there's also just kind of an energy towards moving on with our lives and like, rebuilding our economy and, getting out of this problem. So there was a real desire to unify between North and South. And I think there was also some frustration with freed people. So a lot of Northerners were kind of saying, well, we've been helping freed people for 10 years now, and, why are they stepping up? Like, there some people were kind of saying, they keep wanting more money and like, why can't they, So there started to be some real sort of frustration with the idea that the freed people were not responding well enough to Reconstruction. So I think all of those together, gave even a lot of support in the Republicans for ending Reconstruction. But historians fight about this all the time. So, like, does anybody else have like other questions? Okay. Thank you. I think so. Yeah, that's it. Good questions.